Hey, good morning, everybody. Can you hear me in the back? Sorta, a little bit better. There we go. That's good. Okay, so welcome to class, Bio 241. It is Thursday, the 29th of October, and this is our last October class. And then it's going to be November. So let's take a look at the schedule, exactly where we are. The 29th, maybe we'll get into muscle today. I hope so. We're scheduled to do that. I don't want to get too far behind, because otherwise, if we get far behind, I have to put a lecture online for you guys to listen to, because I don't want to put this exam back any further, because then that makes the last exam even more difficult. So the next exam is 1-2 weeks from today on chapters 10, 11, 12, and 13, and that's November 12th. And you need your basic stuff, 882, Scantron, picture ID, pencil, and an excellent eraser. Just the usual kind of stuff. I don't think you'll need a calculator on this exam. Does anybody have a question on the schedule? I know it's pretty straightforward. Okay, I think I got all my materials back that were erased from the computer, so I'm really happy about that. There is one thing I want to go back and do, and that has to do with the census chapter. We're done with the census chapter, and I want to review the anatomy are necessary for the particular functions in the ear, okay? And I will put this in Blackboard. It might be in Blackboard already, I'm not sure, but let's go over this. I'm going to make it as big as I can, all right, but I'll be able to zoom in. All right, so the title of this synopsis right here, Structures and Functions of the Special Senses of the Petrous Region of the Temporal Bone. Oh, you can't see. Let me get rid of that. One last thing. The labyrinth, right? The labyrinth are all those structures in the temporal bone responsible for static equilibrium, dynamic equilibrium, and hearing. All right, so here are the three senses, and we have hearing. We have static equilibrium. Sometimes we call that, what that measures is linear acceleration, just going backwards and forwards, right? And then kinetic equilibrium is the sense of spinning. We call that angular acceleration, right? So static equilibrium, remember, doesn't monitor velocity. It's the change in velocity, like when you stop or when you start. But if you're going at a constant speed, it doesn't help you out. Same thing for kinetic equilibrium. If you're spinning at a constant rate, it doesn't give you any information, but if you start to spin, if you're standing still and you start to spin, that's where this apparatus will help you maintain balance. Or if you are spinning and you stop, then it will help you maintain your balance as well. And that's what we mean by acceleration. It's when you change your velocity or your rate that you're spinning at. So, how many parts, anybody tell me how many major parts are there to the ear, just the anatomy of the ear? If you're going to look at a picture of the ear, what are the main parts? You got this part out here that's hanging outside your body. Yeah, so you have the external ear, okay, and it's got a couple parts. What are the parts of the external ear? Like the auricle and pinna, right, and the external acoustic meatus, those are all the external parts. Right, and then you have the middle part. And how would you define the middle part? What's in the middle part? Ossicles, auditory ossicles, that's really nice. And the auditory ossicles connect the tympanic membrane with the oval window. So it goes across that space, and don't forget there's a eustachian tube that connects that space with your throat so that the pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane is equal. So that allows the tympanic membrane to vibrate back and forth. If there's high pressure on one side or the other, the tympanic membrane gets pushed in that direction, and then it can't vibrate. And if it can't vibrate, then you can't hear anything. All right, so that's the middle ear. And then the last part is the internal ear. And that's what contains the labyrinth. That's what I have right here. So there's a bony labyrinth. And then inside that is a membranous labyrinth, and then inside that are the receptor organs, and then there are specific receptor cells for these particular senses. And I do want you to know all of that anatomy. All right, so the external ear, when we think of these three functions, which of these senses require an external ear? What about hearing? Plug up your ear. And listen to me. Can you hear me? You can't hear me, even without plugging your ear up. Okay? Well, yeah, of course you need an external ear to hear something, right? Because that sound energy has to enter the cochlea in order to hear something. So you definitely need an external ear. But for static equilibrium, you do not. And for kinetic equilibrium, you do not. Right? If there's damage to those places, it doesn't affect that equilibrium sense or those equilibrium senses at all. What about the middle ear? Do you need those auditory ossicles to hear anything? Yes, indeed you do. Right? So the middle ear is necessary for hearing. Again, it's not necessary for static or kinetic equilibrium. It wouldn't care if you have a middle ear or not, or if you have a big infection in the middle ear, wouldn't matter whatsoever. All right? And then what about the inner ear, internal ear? Yes, you need that for hearing, right? And yes, you need it for static and kinetic equilibrium, both of those. So what part of that inner ear is necessary for each of these particular senses? Well, I think you could tell me for hearing, it is the cochlea. The bony labyrinth is the cochlea. Kind of looks like a snail, right? For static equilibrium, it's in the vestibule. That's what the stapes is connected up to. And then for kinetic equilibrium, it's the semicircular canals. That's the bony labyrinth inside the temporal bone. And inside that bony labyrinth is a membranous labyrinth. For hearing, inside the cochlea, we call it the cochlear duct. And for static equilibrium, it's the maculae, and you got two of them. You got a utricle and saccule. Right? And then for kinetic equilibrium, we call that membranous labyrinth the semicircular duct. Kind of almost like the cochlear duct, but it's inside the semicircular canals. Okay, well, that doesn't allow you to appreciate those senses. You still need a sense organ within that membranous labyrinth. And probably you could tell me, what's the sensory organ for hearing? What's the sensory organ for hearing? Can you recall that? It is the organ of Corti. The organ of Corti, go back and look that up. Right, and the receptor for static equilibrium is the macula, and for angular acceleration, it's the crista ampullaris. And we talked about the structure of these things, right? Some have otoliths, some have gelatinous mass. And each of these then have to have a receptor cell that generates a generator potential or a receptor potential, which is a graded potential proportional to the stimulus strength. Right? And then that gets converted into a string of action potentials that go to the various parts of the brain. Right? What's not on this slide is where do the nerve impulses for hearing go? Where do the action potentials for hearing go so that you can appreciate sound? Can you remember the temporal lobe? Somebody told temporal lobe. Yeah, that's exactly right. All right. So those are the receptor organs that need receptor cells. And what are the receptor cell types called? How about for hearing? It's a hair cell. What about for static equilibrium? Hair cell. The same kind of cell? Strange. What about for kinetic equilibrium? It's a hair cell as well, right? It's those cells that have those cilia or stereocilia that are poking off the apical surface, and when those bend, it changes the electrical properties of those receptor cells, right? They make generator potentials. All right, so I do want you to know this table. Be sure you know what a labyrinth is and know what the bony part is, what the membranous part is, the receptor organ, and the hairs cells are the receptor cells, and know which part of the ear is responsible for each of these three senses. Okay. This is probably you've learned this in anatomy, but maybe you have forgotten. I'm not sure. All right, so just make sure you know that for the test. I'm going to look and see. Okay, I'm going to look and see. It's probably in a PowerPoint, maybe in a study guide someplace, exam study guide. I'll find it. Lecture slide. Oh, nice. Okay, and I'll track it down. Maybe I'll send you guys an email. All right, so let's move on to finish up what we were talking about, and that was endocrinology. And we were looking at different kinds of receptor types for different kinds of hormones. And remember that steroid hormones can actually enter the cell because they can dissolve through the cell membrane, right? Because they're both polar compounds. But Hydrophilic compounds can't get into the cell, so where do the receptors have to be for those hormones that can dissolve in water? They got to be extracellular, right? And so they're put into the membrane, but the receptor is sticking to the outside of the cell. And we looked at a number of them, okay? And if the hormone can't enter the cell, what produces, what's the signaling molecule inside the cell that's going to produce a response? The second messenger, right? And so the hormone itself is what we call the first messenger, and then there's a second messenger, and some second messengers we looked at would be like calcium ions, IP3 and DAG. Okay, and then we looked at this tyrosine kinase receptor. This is very important for the hormone insulin, and people are discovering a lot of other applications for kinase receptor as well. So you'll learn more and more about these. So you see that the tyrosine kinase has two subunits. They don't contact each other until the ligand binds to the binding site, and then it dimerizes. Right. So here is a dimerization of a tyrosine kinase receptor. When that happens, then these two tails that are sticking down into the cytoplasm have an ATPase activity, and it will take an ATP, convert it into ADP, and the leftover phosphate and that energy then is used to phosphorylate the tyrosine kinase receptor itself. And what does that do? That changes the structure of the tyrosine kinase receptor. And the ligand is still bound to it. What's this ligand called once again? Insulin, right? And does insulin enter the cell? It does not. It's extracellular. All right, so maybe you could think of glucose can't enter the cell, and neither can insulin. All right, so once the tyrosine kinase is phosphorylated, then the tyrosine kinase receptor can phosphorylate tyrosine on different proteins that are inside the cell. And tyrosine is just an amino acid. It's just one little building block of a protein. And when it's phosphorylated, that changes the activity of that particular protein. And it can produce a cascade of effects. So tyrosine kinase can activate a number of different kinds of enzymes, right? For a cascade, you need at least two enzymes. It's not just one single level of amplification, but it's a multiple levels of amplification. And that produces a cascade of effects. And then glucose, it allows glucose to diffuse into the cell, and then the cell can use glucose for its metabolic reactions. So glucose enters a cell strictly by diffusion. So how does that work? From what kind of concentration to another kind of concentration? From high concentration to low concentration, right? So even if there's high concentration of glucose outside the cell, it can't get in, right, until it has an opportunity to do that, and it requires a facilitator in order to get across the membrane, right? And insulin doesn't get across either. All right, so this is how that works. But the facilitator is a carrier protein that we call a GLUT4 carrier protein, and we can see that there's high concentration of glucose outside the cell in this region, lower concentration inside. So glucose wants to move into the cell by diffusion, but it can't get through the phospholipid bilayer unless the GLUT4 transporter is in the membrane. If it's in the membrane, then glucose that is extracellular will move by diffusion into that transporter, bind to it, and when it binds to it, that's like somebody poking you in the side, right? That's going to change conformation of this protein, and it's going to act like a teeter-totter. Right, so the extracellular side is going to close, and the intracellular side of the transporter is going to open, and then glucose then moves into the cell down a concentration gradient. So what kind of transport do we call that? Okay, going from high to low, what's going from high to low? That's diffusion, really nice, right? But is this simple diffusion, or is this osmosis, or what the heck is this? Could it be osmosis? I heard facilitated diffusion. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Facilitated diffusion, it's not active transport, and it's not osmosis because, even though here's a selectively permeable membrane, osmosis refers only to the water molecule in us, right? Not the solutes, only the solvent molecule. Okay. So if the membrane has four transporters, glucose can enter the cell. But there has to be a signal to place these transporters in the cell membrane so glucose can get in, and that signal comes from insulin binding to this tyrosine kinase receptor. So without insulin binding to the tyrosine kinase receptor, we find all the GLUT4 transporters embedded in a membrane, but the membrane is forming a vesicle inside the cell, and typically we call these kinds of vesicles endosomes. So all of these transporters, I might say millions of transporters, but probably not that many, but many, many, many transporters are ready to go to work, but they're buried inside the cell in these membranes that make up an endosome. All right, so take all of these GLUT4 transporters away from the cell membrane and these over here as well, put them in an endosome. So we've removed all of these GLUT4 transporters, put them in an endosome. Can this cell take glucose up from the extracellular fluid? Right? It cannot. So this cell is going to starve to death because glucose can't get in. Well, if glucose concentration in the blood is high in a normal individual, the pancreas is going to secrete insulin, right? Insulin's going to bind to the tyrosine kinase receptor, and we know that by a number of steps of phosphorylation, it's going to produce other kinds of enzymes and molecules that can translocate these endosomes over to the cell membrane, and when they touch the cell membrane, right, they just kind of mesh together very easily because the membrane of an endosome, membrane of the cell is exactly the same. And when that happens, then all of these transporters are immediately in the cell membrane ready to go to work and allowing glucose to enter. Right, so you just got to remember what a cascade of events that happen inside the cell. All right, so I think that's kind of interesting because if there's an insulin signal, there is just one molecule binding to one receptor. Right, but that produces a cascade, and as a result of that, you can have many, many, probably many thousands of these GLUT4 transporters active inside the membrane within a very short period of time. If the cell, had to build all of these proteins, all of these carrier proteins, I don't know how long it would take. It would take maybe a day or two or a month, right? And in the meantime, the cell would not have glucose. So this is a really efficient, fast way for this cell to take up glucose when there is a nice insulin signal. All right, so probably you know there's at least two different kinds of diabetes mellitus, which is when glucose can't enter the cell. The first kind is when the body is not producing insulin, and then that doesn't activate the tyrosine kinase receptor. Right? And so cells can't take up glucose. They start to starve to death when that happens. Right, there's another kind where insulin levels are normal, but there is something wrong with the receptor, the tyrosine kinase receptor. Or maybe the receptor is okay, but something's wrong with this cascade of events inside the cell. So it's a much more complicated scenario, and people are really interested to know each of those particular steps. Maybe it has to do with translocation of the endosome, or maybe it has to do with some other signaling compound inside the cell, and then when we know what the problem is, then hopefully some kind of pharmaceutical agent would aid in expressing inside the cell when insulin binds to the tyrosine kinase receptor. Right, so those are the two kinds. And I think you can appreciate the second kind relies on kind of a complicated mechanism right here. Right, so it's actually pretty prevalent. All right, so that's the action of insulin. And insulin comes from the pancreas, and in particular, the islets of Langerhans in the pancreas. I don't think they had a slide of that, did we? Maybe later. All right, pituitary gland, important endocrine gland. And we know where the thalamus is, and the hypothalamus is right below it. And the third ventricle is right between the walls of the hypothalamus. So right now I have the arrow kind of floating around in the third ventricle, but if we bump up against the wall, that's the hypothalamus. Right below the hypothalamus and sort of right below the optic chiasma is the pituitary gland. And when you look at this pituitary gland, does all the pieces of it look the same? Or do they look different? Do you see any differences in here? Okay. And there is an anterior part and a posterior part to the pituitary. The posterior part really is just an extension of the brain. It is neuronal tissue. The anterior part is glandular tissue. Comes more from epithelium than nervous tissue. So these are inherently different kinds of structures, but they're put together. They both communicate with the hypothalamus via the stalk right here, which we call the infundibulum. That's probably a better way of talking about it. All right, so look at your end of chapter questions and review questions as to what the detail is that you have to know about these different lobes. I don't think you have to know about the median eminence. All right, maybe you have to know something about adenohypophysis. Hypophysis is another name for pituitary. And adeno stands for glandular, right? An adenocarcinoma is a cancer that comes from some kind of gland somewhere in your body, right? The neurohypophysis again, is pituitary. Neuro means that it is made up of nervous system tissue. And you can see this on this slide pretty easily, right? Both of these lobes, both the anterior and posterior lobe, and that's how I'm going to refer to them, not as adenohypophysis or neurohypophysis, but I think it's going to help for you to understand what's happening here. All right, so here is the posterior pituitary. And we can see that there are some nuclei in the hypothalamus, like the paraventricular supraoptic. Supraoptic means what? Right above the optic chiasma. Paraventricular means that they're on either side of the third ventricle in the wall of the hypothalamus. And why do we call this thing a nucleus? Are we looking at a cell, or what the heck are we looking at right here? It's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, right, that have a particular function, and those things are not myelinated, and so it's going to look like gray matter. As opposed to these axons over here coming from the nucleus, these things are myelinated, and that's going to make white matter in the hypothalamus. And where do these axons go? They go down through the infundibulum all the way down into the posterior pituitary. And what does a neuron secrete from the axon terminus? Okay, it secretes a neurotransmitter. But in this particular case, that substance is not exciting another neuron through a synapse. That substance is being released just into the extracellular fluid, and here is a capillary, and so that substance will move by diffusion from the extracellular space into the capillary, and then it goes everywhere that blood goes in your body. So that compound released by these axons really is a neurohormone, right? Because it comes from a neuron, but it's acting like a hormone. And there are two, which is really nice because we talked about these two nuclei right here. The two hormones are antidiuretic hormone and oxytocin. So the posterior pituitary secretes only two. ADH. Who can tell me what the function of ADH is? It's in the name, antidiuretic hormone. Okay? Does it make you conserve water or make you lose water? Makes you conserve water, right? So it reduces urine volume. And oxytocin, anybody know what oxytocin is? Can't mess around with this one. It is a smooth muscle stimulant, right? So it contracts smooth muscle, particularly of the uterus during parturition, and also of the muscle tissues of the ducts of the breast. It helps, it participates in the milk letdown reflex. All right, so that is the posterior pituitary. What else do we want to say about that? I think that's pretty much about it, those two. So when action potentials come down this white matter, which we call the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract, right? Hypothalamo means that it's coming from the hypothalamus and it's going to the hypophysis, which is the pituitary. Hypophysis, just another name for pituitary. And we know that that is the posterior pituitary. Okay, anterior pituitary receives signals from the hypothalamus. It's under control of the hypothalamus, and it's under the control of some other kinds of neurohormones. In this particular case, we see the cell bodies in the hypothalamus, but the axons of those cell bodies only make it right to this proximal part of the infundibulum, and there they stop. So when an action potential comes down this axon, it stops right here, and a neurohormone is released, but that's okay because I see a capillary. So it enters the circulation through this capillary, then it moves through this blood vessel that goes through the infundibulum into the anterior pituitary. And what kind of blood vessel do you see in the anterior pituitary? I see another network, another capillary network. And what's the function of a capillary again? Exchange, right? So in this first capillary, neurohormones can enter. The second capillary, they can leave because they're at low concentration inside the anterior pituitary, and there's a capillary right there. And this is called the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal blood vessel, because remember, when you have two capillary beds back-to-back, before it goes back to the heart, that's called a portal system, like what we like you saw in the kidney and also in the liver, right? Like the hepatic portal system. Okay. So these neurohormones that go to the anterior pituitary are what we call releasing hormones or releasing factors. It could be called either one, either RH or RF. So if there is a hormone called thyroid stimulating hormone released by the anterior pituitary, it needs a releasing hormone from the hypothalamus. Right, so the hormone from the anterior pituitary would be called TSH, or thyroid stimulating hormone. The neurohormone from the hypophysis right here would be called TSHRH, thyroid stimulating hormone releasing hormone, or you could say TSHRF. Either one would work just fine, and everybody would know that it's a neurohormone from the hypothalamus. Maybe I'll draw that on the board in just a little bit after we finish up the pituitary. All right, so what are the hormones that are released from the anterior pituitary as a result of getting exposure to releasing factors or releasing hormones from the hypothalamus? All right, the first one is prolactin, and I see a breast right here. Well, I'm sorry, mammary gland. Let's think of mammary gland. That's a better way of thinking about it. All right, so there's glandular tissue that produces milk, and it's stored in that glandular tissue. And for milk letdown reflex, then there are ducts that can take milk to the nipple over here. All right, so there are two hormones that are necessary to nourish an infant. There's prolactin. Prolactin allows the glandular tissue of the breast to develop and become competent to produce milk. All right, so that's the deal with prolactin. It just allows for a proliferation of the glandular tissue so that it can produce milk but not secrete milk. What's the hormone necessary to secrete milk? That would be oxytocin, right? So proliferation and production of milk is controlled by prolactin, but the letdown of milk is controlled by oxytocin, two different parts of the pituitary gland, namely prolactin from the anterior pituitary, oxytocin from the posterior pituitary. All right, one more, growth hormone. This is necessary for growth of bones and muscle and adipose tissue, especially during development, probably even nervous tissue. Without it, somebody will have a very small stature. And sometimes people grow up kind of small, and they would think, well, gee whiz, can I just get a shot of growth hormone just to grow bigger, maybe artificially bigger? And experience has shown that does not work very well. It causes more side effects than it helps the individual. Okay, but if there is some problem with the pituitary to where it's not secreting growth hormone, then some exogenous or supplemental growth hormone would really help that person develop. Okay. All right, so those are two, prolactin and growth hormone. TSH, or thyroid stimulating hormone, from the anterior pituitary goes to the thyroid. And since it is a trophic hormone, like all of these over here, right, it causes the thyroid gland to grow and also secrete thyroid hormone. So without this trophic hormone, the thyroid gland would regress. It would go away. Okay? But with TSH, it's going to grow and secrete thyroid hormone if it has all of the necessary pieces. What's one kind of funny piece that the thyroid gland needs to make a competent thyroid hormone? It's just an element, kind of a funny element. Iodine, that's right. So if a person, and we can't make iodine, it's just an element. And if a person doesn't have iodine in their diet, then the thyroid gland cannot make thyroid hormone. And the hypothalamus realizes that. And so it's going to tell the anterior pituitary to release a lot of TSH. That's going to go to the thyroid gland. The thyroid gland is going to grow, and keep growing, and it's going to produce something that's not a competent thyroid hormone. Hypothalamus is going to know that, and so it's going to increase levels of TSH via the anterior pituitary. Thyroid is going to grow even more, but it still can't make thyroid hormone because there's no iodine. Right? So that stimulates the growth. That's one of the things what we mean by atrophic hormone. Right? It allows for growth and also secretion of a hormone. So somebody that doesn't have iodine in their diet has a very enlarged thyroid gland, and that's what we call goiter. And goiter can hopefully be treated just by introducing iodine to somebody's diet. Okay. Another hormone, ACTH. That stands for adrenal corticotropic hormone. So again, it's a tropic hormone. And what part of the, and A stands for adrenal. What part of the adrenal gland is going to be maintained and grow and secrete hormones when ACTH is there? It's the cortex, the adrenal cortex, right? So here is adrenal corticotropic hormone, and there are a number of hormones then that will be secreted when ACTH is presented to them. So there are ACTH receptors in the cortex. All right, so what do we got? Prolactin, growth hormone, TSH, and ACTH. Make sure you know what these acronyms stand for. And then there are also gonadotropins released by the anterior pituitary. And it just so happens that these hormones work on gonads. And you know gonads to be either an ovary or a testes. These are the primary reproductive organs in people. And these organs do a couple of different things. They produce gametes, and a gamete is a cell that has half the number of chromosomes compared to a usual cell in your body. Okay, and so what kind of gamete is produced by an ovary? An egg, right? Has 23 chromosomes. All the other cells in your body have 46. Well, how did you get 46? Well, because this thing over here, testes, produces another kind of gamete that we call a sperm, right? And it has 23 chromosomes, so that when an egg and sperm join together, how many chromosomes do you have? You get back to 46, right? Okay. So a sex cell, like a gamete, like an egg or sperm, have half the number, but as a result of fertilization, then the normal complement of chromosomes is inside that cell. So both follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone are responsible for gametogenesis, or the production of eggs and sperm, but these hormones are also responsible for causing these organs to secrete sex steroids. Right? And males have one, namely testosterone, and females have three. And guys really feel bad about that, left out. Okay? And the three are estrogen, progesterone, and some testosterone as well. Okay? Okay. Testosterone mostly comes from the adrenal gland, but a little bit from the ovary, while the testes produces and secretes pretty much testosterone, and that's about it. Okay, so these, the ovary and testes, two main functions, produce gametes and secrete hormones. That's their function. And that's controlled by follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. Follicle-stimulating hormone supports the production or maturation of egg and sperm, while LH in the female causes the ovulation to take place, and LH in the male causes the testes to produce and release testosterone. In the very last week, we're going to talk about the reproductive cycle in people, and that's going to be really interesting. So don't forget about these gonadotropins. So what's a gonad once again? Give me an example. Give me an example of a gonad. I can't hear. Nobody has a good opinion about that? Ovary, yeah. Or testes. Yeah, ovary or testes. Those are gonads. And sometimes they're called orchids as well. Maybe we'll run into that term a little bit later. And a tropin is a hormone that causes those structures to grow. So without FSH and LH, right, the ovary and testes are going to regress. They need FSH and LH in order to maintain themselves, to function. Otherwise, they'll disappear. Not completely, but they'll regress. All right, so those are the six hormones that I want you to know something about. This is an exam figure, and it's really easy to know all of these hormones if you can link it up to this exam figure. Really nice visual. Okay, so the paraventricular nucleus, supraoptic nucleus. These send the nerve impulses right down to this first capillary, and then it enters the second capillary in the anterior pituitary. Remember, we call that a portal system, and that portal system is the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal blood vessel. Right, is that portal blood vessel right there. All right, so here is just a synopsis of what we said so far, so I don't think I'm going to read this for you. So that's okay. Anterior pituitary are controlled by what we said, releasing hormones, right, from the hypothalamus. So let me turn some lights on, and let's see if we can figure out what some of these things are. All right, so what does that look like? Infundibulum. What does this look like? Pituitary gland. All right. What does this look like? Hypothalamus. Okay, and I'm just going to put an I here because I want to draw on this. And don't forget, what about the pituitary gland? We want to break it down into a couple parts, right? Posterior, and don't forget, posterior releases ADH and oxytocin, I'll abbreviate it like that, and I'm not going to write down all the hormones, but six hormones you should know from the anterior pituitary, including, right, maybe I'll draw it like this, including thyroid stimulating hormone, TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone. Where does TSH go? To the thyroid gland, right? And it maintains the function of the thyroid gland and its shape because it's a trophic hormone. And then the thyroid gland will release its hormones, which we saw were T3 and T4. Triiodothreonine and tetraiodothreonine, right? Those are the thyroid hormones that go everywhere in the body when they get a signal from TSH. So what we want to know right now is, what is telling the anterior pituitary to release thyroid-stimulating hormone? It is something that we call TSH, and you could say RH if you want to, releasing hormone, or you could call it RF. Doesn't matter to me. I look at the end of the chapter questions. They might like one or the other, especially if it's a fill-in-the-blank kind of question. Okay. All right, so these hormones are water-soluble hormones. They're released in this area here. How do they get down into the anterior pituitary? Okay, by a portal system, right? The hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system. There's capillaries here that pick it up, capillaries in the anterior pituitary. So basically, TSHRH is going to move by diffusion down into the anterior pituitary. Even though they get a little support with this portal blood vessel, that portal system is a door-to-door delivery system, so very small quantities of these releasing factors have to be produced. Right? If the hypothalamus released that same quantity of releasing factor and it got diluted in the whole circulation, it probably would not have the effect that it does, right? So that's just a way of keeping the concentration. All right, so that's one. Here is another one, all right, that goes to, oh, that's great. That's an adrenal gland, right? And I see the adrenal cortex right here. So what affects the adrenal cortex? ACTH, okay? And that is from the anterior pituitary. And what tells the anterior pituitary to release ACTH? It is a neural hormone from the hypothalamus that we can call ACTH-RH or RF. I think your book uses a term that's not commonly used. I think they use CRF, corticotropin releasing factor. Something like that. But that's the same thing. I like ACTHRH because then I know exactly what's going on. All right. What about those gonadotropins? Where do gonadotropins come from? Anterior or posterior? Anterior or posterior? They come from the anterior, All right, and we call these things gonadotropins. And so they're trophic hormones that maintain the function and size of ovaries and testes. Look, it's plural. How many are there? Two. And you know their names? All right, they're going to be LH and follicle stimulating hormone, FSH. All right, so there are two. One, two. Both of these are gonadotropins. There is one hormone from the anterior pituitary that goes to an ovary or testes, and it is called these are the gonadotropins. Okay. There are hormones, neurohormones, from the hypothalamus that go into the anterior pituitary,
which tell the anterior pituitary to release FSH and LH, which are gonadotropins. So what is this hormone right here?
This one is called GnRH. Gonadotropin, which refers to LH and FSH, RH,
releasing hormone. All right, so those are the only three I'm going to do. You could do three more, but that's okay, right? All right, it's just the name of the hormone with RH or RF on the end of it, and we'll know exactly what that is. Okay, well, here's a nice graphic of the portal system. Okay, we don't need to do that anymore. Let's talk about some physiology now that we've reviewed a lot of the anatomy. Feedback control of the anterior pituitary. And you're familiar with that. There are different kinds of feedback loops. There's short and long feedback loops. And to maintain homeostasis, what kind of feedback loop should be used typically? A nice negative feedback loop, right? And it's going to be interesting because we're going to see maybe a little bit of change in that. But let's look at just a usual kind of scenario. So here's the hypothalamus. It wants to control the anterior pituitary, and let's just say that it wants to stimulate the anterior pituitary to release FSH and LH. And FSH and LH together are called gonadotropins, right? Because they go to the ovaries or testes. All right, so how does the hypothalamus tell the anterior pituitary to release FSH and LH? Is it a action potential that goes to the anterior pituitary, or is it a neurohormone? It's a neurohormone, and we call it just GnRH, gonadotropin releasing hormone, through that portal blood vessel, right, the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system to the anterior pituitary. Anterior pituitary then releases FSH and LH, and that goes to the gonads, maintains their function. And what were the two functions of these gonads? How do they respond to FSH and LH? They produce gametes, right? They produce gametes like sperm or eggs, and they produce sex steroids like estrogen and progesterone. And that's what we see right here. So we're not so concerned about sperm and egg cells. We're looking at estrogens and androgens, depending on what kind of gonad it is. They go into the blood, and when they're in the blood, where can they go? They can go back to the anterior pituitary, or they can go back to the hypothalamus. They go back both places. And as the concentrations of estrogen and androgens increase, what do you think will happen in the hypothalamus and anterior pituitary? They will stop secreting or dial back the secretion of trophic hormone or stimulating hormones. Right, so as estrogens feed back to the hypothalamus, then the hypothalamus is beginning to realize, well, the level is at the set point. I don't need to secrete so much GnRH. Right? And then the anterior pituitary won't secrete gonadotropins, and then the gonads won't secrete so much estrogen. So that is a nice negative feedback loop. So that's a long feedback loop. There is a short feedback loop because these sex steroids are monitored by the anterior pituitary, and again, it's a negative feedback loop, so that if estrogens and androgens are at the set point, then the anterior pituitary is going to reduce the secretion of FSH and LH as a result of that. Okay. So there are a couple different feedback loops, and I think it maybe be just sort of interesting. Some athletes like to take
steroids to build muscle mass, all right? Like, for instance, androgen-type drugs. So how does that affect their physiology? Of course, their muscles are going to get huge, you know, like Arnold Schwarzenegger, huge, huge, huge. All right, but what are those anabolic steroids going to do to the rest of the individual? So let's put some androgens in somebody's blood. Okay, just give them a shot. Where do they go? They go to the anterior pituitary. They go to the hypothalamus, right? And what's the feedback? It's negative feedback. All right, so when that testosterone in a shot goes to the anterior pituitary, what's the response of the anterior pituitary? It's going to stop secreting FSH and LH, right? Because there's way more high levels of androgens than are necessary. So anterior pituitary will stop secreting FSH and LH. And so what happens to these gonads then? These are trophic hormones. They'll stop secreting, right? And they'll stop producing sperm, for instance, if it's, well, because we're talking about a guy, let's talk about a guy. Right, so these gonads stop producing sperm, but not only does it promote gametogenesis, but it's a trophic hormone. It maintains the shape and size of a testes. And if you take that away, what happens to the testes? They shrivel up, right? Which is kind of, yeah, I know, it's kind of funny how that happens. All right, well, that's just one feedback loop. Same thing, you take anabolic steroids, right, to build muscle mass, goes back to the hypothalamus, right, and the hypothalamus stops secreting GnRH, and the anterior pituitary secretes even less FSH and LH, less trophic hormones to the gonads. What happens to them? Again, they shrivel up. Okay, so, I don't know, it's kind of ironic that a weightlifter might build a lot of muscle mass, okay, skeletal muscle mass, at the same time their gonads are shriveling up. Okay, it's just sort of interesting. Okay, and we're going to look at how the infertility pill works as well in a little bit. Okay, and we're going to talk about positive feedback at the end of the class, but not right now. We're just interested in these negative feedback loops. Okay. Higher brain function can affect the hypothalamus because it's in the brain. So emotional states, psychological stress can affect menstrual cycle and reproductive function because the hypothalamus is an integral part of this process right here. All right, posterior pituitary. Kind of talked about these already. Remember, only two hormones, ADH and vasopressin, oxytocin, responsible for the milk letdown reflex. Here is something that's pretty important. Another name for ADH is called vasopressin. Okay, so circle that, write that down or something. We know that ADH helps conserve water, right? It makes an individual produce a small amount of very concentrated urine so that a person conserves water or retains water. But ADH also has another effect on blood vessels. And that's how it got actually its first name, called vasopressin. Any kind of compound that is a pressor increases blood pressure, right? And it does so mostly by constricting blood vessels. So think of a balloon, grab a balloon, and start to squeeze it. What happens to pressure inside the balloon when you start to squeeze it? Does it stay the same, go up or go down? It goes up, right? And if you squeeze really hard, it's going to pop, right? Because the pressure is too high. All right, so vasopressin causes vasoconstriction of blood vessels, which increases blood pressure. All right, and both of those effects, when you maintain water balance in your body and shrink blood vessel size, both of those work synergistically to increase or maintain blood pressure. All right, so those are the hormones from the posterior pituitary. Adrenal gland. What do we have to know about the adrenal gland? Two main areas, medulla and cortex. The medulla we talked about already. The cells of the medulla are chromaffin cells. They're acting like a postganglionic sympathetic neuron. They don't send nerve impulses anywhere. But when acetylcholine from the preganglionic neuron releases acetylcholine in the adrenal medulla, those chromaffin cells then secrete norepinephrine and epinephrine. Okay, so those are the signaling compounds of a typical postganglionic cell. But then those hormones get picked up by the blood and distributed everywhere in the body. Right? So sometimes we might want to consider those things neurohormones in this particular case. So that's the medulla. Here is the cortex. We can see many layers in the cortex, and that's because the cortex synthesizes and secretes a number of different kinds of hormones. And I'm not going to have you memorize, do I have a large slide of it? No, I'm not going to have you memorize the different zones in the cortex, right? So here's medulla. I just want you to know that here's adrenal medulla, here's cortex. Cortex does have different regions secreting different kinds of hormones. So what are these things? The cortex is controlled by adrenal corticotropic hormone. And so it will regress if ACTH is not there, but if it is there, it will maintain its size and it will secrete a number of different things. There are hormones from the cortex that will regulate glucose metabolism, and then there are other hormones from the cortex that will regulate sodium and potassium levels in our body. So sometimes we think of sodium and potassium as minerals, so there are hormones that we call mineralocorticoids, corticoids because they come from the cortex, mineralo because they affect sodium and potassium. And the other hormones that affect glucose utilization are called glucocorticoids. Glucocorticoids are something that affect glucose metabolism, and they come from the cortex of the adrenal gland. Examples of a glucocorticoid would be cortisol. Okay. And an example of a mineralocorticoid would be aldosterone. And also the cortex secretes some sex steroids, primarily androgens. That's where females get androgens from. All right, so here we can see that we got cortisol, corticosterone, right? We see some androgens produced by the cortex and some aldosterone. Right? So aldosterone is that mineralocorticoid. Glucocorticoids are like corticosterone and cortisone, and you can see the different levels they come from. But the important point is that all of these important hormones start with the same precursor, which is cholesterol. All right, so that's really what I want you to see on this slide. And you can see that aldosterone actually comes from modification of progesterone. We said progesterone is one of the female sex steroids, along with estrogen. Okay, I don't see progesterone. Estrogen also leads to other androgens, but I don't see that pathway on this slide. Okay, so that's the adrenal cortex. Adrenal medulla, I don't think I'm going to say much about the adrenal medulla, right, because we talked about the autonomic nervous system already. One thing, though, that I didn't mention is that epinephrine, right, will stimulate glycogenolysis and lipolysis. Well, what's the end result of glycogenolysis? It's breakdown of glycogen, and what does it produce in particular? Yeah, glucose, right? And that glucose ends up in the blood. Okay, so sympathetic response increases blood glucose levels. So do you know any kind of pathology where blood glucose levels are chronically high, always high, maybe? Diabetes, right? So here is one particular mechanism for producing diabetes. Lipolysis is a way of releasing energy, and that might suppress glucose utilization as well. Okay, so here, what I'm going to make a big long list of things that will increase blood glucose levels, and here's just one of the things that you're going to find in that list, right? Epinephrine will do that, or sympathetic stimulation. Thyroid gland. Thyroid gland, just right below the larynx, okay, secretes these hormones, T3 and T4, and that's necessary for development and sets basal metabolic rate. There are cells that form spherical structures that we call follicles inside the thyroid gland. Those spherical structures contain a fluid that we call colloid. It's rich in protein, and here is a picture of a follicle, so here's that ring of cells. These ring of cells will absorb iodide and secrete it into the colloid, and then there are various enzymes that undergo oxidation reduction reactions to take this iodide and convert it into iodine. And they bind to a protein we call thyroglobulin inside the colloid of this follicle. And then it's converted into monoiodothreonine, diiodothreonine, and then these can be combined to make what? Triiodothreonine or tetraiodothreonine. So thyroglobulin is necessary to make T3 and T4 along with iodine that's in your diet, iodide. And what releases this T3 and T4 from the colloid is thyroid-stimulating hormone from the anterior pituitary. And remember, T3 and T4 are hydrophobic compounds, like a steroid, and so they have to be carried in the circulatory system with another kind of globulin. Right, so these are just protein carrier molecules in the plasma that carry T3 and T4. All right, so maybe put a little an arrow with a TSH, right, pointing to this follicle, saying that it is a trophic hormone necessary for secretion and synthesis of thyroid hormone. So here we have thyroid gland. Here we have hypothalamus. Hypothalamus has got to tell the anterior pituitary to release thyroid-stimulating hormone, and that is what we call, your book calls TRH. You could call it TSHRH. That's fine. Other textbooks do that. Right? That's the neural hormone. Goes to the anterior pituitary, releases thyroid-stimulating hormone, goes to the thyroid, and it causes the thyroid to grow or maintain its size, as well as synthesize and secrete thyroid hormone. What are the two thyroid hormones? T3 and T4. The active form inside cells is T3, but it's mostly T4 that's found in the blood. It's converted to T3 inside of a cell. All right, so the thyroid gland releases T3 and T4, and this T3 and T4 will feed back to the anterior pituitary, and if it's above the set point, then the anterior pituitary will stop secreting TSH. If it's below the set point, then the anterior pituitary will release more TSH, and that's just a nice classic negative feedback loop. All right, and that is if iodine is present. If iodine is not present, right, then the thyroid gland makes very, very low levels of T3 and T4 because there's no iodine on that particular molecule. And the anterior pituitary won't recognize those incompetent thyroid hormones, and it will just see that thyroid hormone is way below the set point. So what is the anterior pituitary going to do when thyroid hormone is way below the set point? And it's going to tell the thyroid gland to get busy, grow, and make thyroid hormone. So there's going to be excess TSH, and the thyroid gland is going to grow. We call that hypertrophy. Right? And so it's going to grow and get bigger, and it's going to produce a lot of incompetent thyroid hormone because it is a thyroid hormone without iodine, so it's not T3 or T4. And again, the anterior pituitary will recognize that and will stimulate the thyroid gland even more, and we said that will result in a goiter. All right, so this is a nice feedback loop showing how goiter can develop. Parathyroid hormones are located, okay, in either lobe of the thyroid gland, posterior part of the thyroid gland, so we can't really see them, but they're like little raisins here, and here, on either side, right? That's why they got the name para, okay? They're released, is stimulated by a decrease in blood calcium levels. Now, is blood calcium important for anything? What's calcium? What are calcium ions necessary for? Muscle contraction, right, synaptic transmission, and making strong bones. All right, so you need proper levels of calcium. And so parathyroid hormone acts on the bones to decrease bone mass, right, then put that calcium that was in bone into blood. It will affect the kidney so that we resorb as much calcium as possible from filtrate. And it has an effect on intestines to enhance absorption of calcium that's in our diet, right? And all of those things will feed back negatively. The stimulus was a decrease in blood calcium, and the response then will be making some calcium, getting it from bones, stop throwing so much away in the kidneys, and increase the input of calcium into your body. All three effects. All right, so let's take a look at this. Is that what's happening here? Decreasing blood calcium is the stimulus. Parathyroids can monitor calcium levels, and it's going to release parathyroid hormone, and it goes to the kidneys, causes more resorption of calcium. That's going to increase blood calcium levels. Parathyroid hormone also goes to bone, and it stimulates a certain kind of cell in bone, which is called an osteo, you should know. Osteo what? Osteocyte? Osteoblast? You guys are shaking your head. No. Okay. I won't even have to tell you because you all know, right? An osteoclast. Yeah, an osteoclast. All right, so parathyroids activate osteoclasts. Again, that increases blood calcium levels, and that feeds back in a nice negative feedback mechanism to the parathyroid glands. Okay. Islets of Langerhans. Well, we talked a little bit about insulin with regard to that tyrosine kinase receptor system. And here is the pancreas. Right? You should be familiar with the ducts that go through it and the shape and where it's located and all that kind of stuff. And that the pancreas is both an exocrine gland and an endocrine gland. So the exocrine gland part secretes things into this duct, which take it to the small intestine, namely precursors to digestive enzymes. And the endocrine part secretes a number of hormones, and we're going to talk about insulin and its antagonist, which is called glucagon. Okay. All right, so here are there are follicles that produce digestive enzymes, and then there's pieces between the follicles, and they're called islands, and they have a number of different kinds of cells, okay, alpha and beta cells, and they secrete their products just into the extracellular fluid, then gets picked up by a capillary and delivered all over the body. So the alphas secrete glucagon in response to low blood glucose. So where does glucagon work? Where, if your blood glucose is low, where can you go and get some glucose if you were you? Your liver, yeah, it's loaded with glycogen, so glucagon stimulates glycogenolysis, and I think we maybe looked at that. You know, what else did we say? Epinephrine, norepinephrine does as well. Okay, glucagon does. Stimulates glycogenolysis, increases blood glucose. Those are from the alpha cells. The beta cells secrete insulin when blood glucose is high, and what is happening when insulin is secreted? Activates the tyrosine kinase receptor. That activates insertion of GLUT4 transporters into the cell membrane via cascade of events when the tyrosine kinase becomes activated. And then glucose can move by facilitated diffusion into the cell. That seems like a long process, but don't forget those GLUT4 transporters don't have to be made. They don't have to be produced. They're ready to go to work. They're stored in an endosome inside the cell. All right, so let's take a look at this feedback loop, see if it makes sense. Increased blood glucose that stimulates the beta cells to release insulin. Insulin is going to increase cellular uptake of blood glucose by inserting those GLUT4 transporters. So if glucose leaves the blood and goes inside of a cell, what happens to blood glucose levels then? It goes down, right? All right, and that feeds back negatively to these beta cells once again. And you can read this down over here. What did I want to say? Those GLUT4 transporters. Oh, that's that last slide. The GLUT4 transporters, all right, are inserted into the membrane as a result of this insulin signal, right? If there's no insulin signal, then that is a type 1 diabetes. And if somebody doesn't produce insulin, that glucose can't get inside cells. But there is something marvelous. There's another way that GLUT4 transporters can be inserted into the cell membrane of a starving cell. And it is a skeletal muscle cell that is contracting. So exercise, just exercising, will decrease blood glucose because it will do the same thing as insulin. It's terrible that you have to, and that's why people just hate this class. Because the two most important things that you can do in your life are watch your diet and exercise, right? So exercise can't completely reverse diabetes type 1 or type 2, but
But certainly it is very, very helpful because it allows glucose to enter cells that have no chance otherwise, right?
So that's really an amazing thing about exercise. So if you know somebody or if you have diabetes, probably you've heard that before. Maybe you didn't understand the mechanism, but it is important and it's really, really good advice. All right, so that's the endocrine chapter. So our next topic, what's our next topic? Muscle, I think. Let's take a look and see what we have for muscle. All right, so what's the function of muscle? What's the purpose of muscle? What does it do? So we have a muscle cell. What is it specialized to do? So just get shorter. Contraction, right? So you could say motility or motion or moving your skeleton around. That's really true. But it does all of that by contraction, right? So contraction is the key term right there. Structure. I won't go over structure too much, but maybe today is a good review, just really quick. All right, so here we have a bone. Here we have a muscle. The connective tissue connection between muscle and bone is called a tendon, right? And that's just dense, regular connective tissue. If you have a whole muscle, it's broken down into fascicles. So I see fascicles. And then if we look at a fascicle, I see structures inside of a fascicle. Those are going to be muscle cells. And since it's attached to this bone, what kind of muscle cell is that going to be? What kind of muscle attaches to your skeleton? Skeletal muscle. Okay, that's how it got its name. Sometimes things are just really, really simple. All right, so here we see a muscle cell. In this particular case, it's called a fiber because it is long and linear. Sorry, I got to get my cursor back. Long and linear. It looks like a thread. And we just call that, arrow options, we just call that a fiber then. All right, a skeletal muscle cell only, not cardiac, not smooth, but a skeletal muscle cell is called a fiber because it's long and narrow. At one time, it was hundreds of different cells that joined together, and so a muscle fiber also has all of those nuclei inside of it as well. Okay, and if we look at this muscle cell, zoom inside the muscle cell, do you see structure inside the muscle cell? Do you see stuff in there? I do, okay? There are organelles for contraction. So this tube is one, this tube is one. So this muscle cell has maybe 10 of these tubes for contraction. These things are what we call myofibrils. So what is the organelle for contraction inside a muscle fiber? It is a myofibril. And if we look inside a myofibril, do you see structure? Yes, you see myofilaments. Your book just says filaments, but they're myofilaments. So if we put a bunch of, and you got a couple of different kinds of myofilaments, probably you can remember two of the major kinds. They are actin and myosin. One is thin, the other is thick, right? So if we put actin and myosin together, or if we put myofilaments together, what do we build? A myofibril. If we put myofibrils together, what do we build? A fiber. If we put a bunch of fibers together, what do we get? A fascicle. You don't have to say fasciculus, unless you want to, okay? And if we put a bunch of fascicles together, we get a muscle, right? So that's the hierarchical organization of muscle. And maybe you should know the connective tissues around these various structures. For instance, like around every single cell, okay? We're going to call that the endomysium. And around every fascicle, we're going to call that the perimysium. And then the connective tissue that's on top of the whole muscle itself is called the epimysium. Okay? So epi on top, endo at the bottom, peri in the middle. Okay. So when we look at this, here I see some muscle fibers. I see three of them. What is very noteworthy? What jumps out at you right away? All these striations. Yep, and I see many nuclei inside of the cell, but striations is what I was looking for. These striations are there because of the internal machinery that's necessary for those myofibrils to contract, which then causes the muscle fiber to contract. So you should know what the name of that structural and functional unit of that machine that causes contraction. This structural and functional unit is called a sarcomere, right? So this is just a lineup of sarcomeres from one end of the muscle fiber to the other. All right, so we're going to look at skeletal muscle. So here is the plasma membrane of a skeletal muscle cell. We call that the sarcolemma. And then here is a neuron that's going to excite the skeletal muscle cell. And what kind of neuron is that? Is that an autonomic neuron? You would say no. It is a somatic motor neuron, right? And it has this huge axon terminus. And there's just a huge number of vesicles that contain neurotransmitter, which you know to be acetylcholine, right? And on the sarcolemma, there are receptors for acetylcholine that are always excitatory. What kind of acetylcholine receptor you know is 100% all the time excitatory? It's a nicotinic type receptor, right? So because of the massive nature of this axon terminus that makes this neuromuscular junction, and the massive amount of acetylcholine that's released, and the massive amount of ligand-gated receptors for acetylcholine of that nicotinic type, whenever this somatic motor neuron transmits a nerve impulse to the axon terminus, enough acetylcholine is produced, so it's always going to result in an action potential on this skeletal muscle cell. And you know action potential is excitatory, which is going to cause contraction. All right, so not only, right, and they're not drawn on this slide, right, but on the sarcolemma, not only are there ligand-gated channels, those nicotinic-type controlled channels, right, there are also voltage-gated channels. Maybe not smack in the middle of the neuromuscular junction, maybe on the periphery, but you could consider them, right, really an integral part of the neuromuscular junction. As soon as those ligand-gated channels produce a graded potential, those graded potentials basically don't have to travel anywhere, right, to excite voltage-gated channels that are right within the neuromuscular junction. Because what could you tell me about a graded potential if they had to travel far? They would die away, right? And what else about graded potentials? Could happen. They summate, that's right. So they summate and they can add to each other, and we're going to see that they can even subtract from each other, right? If it's an IPSP or an EPSP, it all depends. Right, so in the neuromuscular junction, only EPSPs are produced, right? And that's because of that nicotinic type channel. We're going to see in smooth muscle, because of those adrenergic type receptors, you can have EPSPs and IPSPs. So smooth muscle can make a decision on when to contract, how much to contract, depending on what kind of signals it's getting from the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. But what about this skeletal muscle right here? Once that action potential comes down, skeletal muscle contracts for those reasons that we talked about. Can't make up its mind, it just obeys, and so we know that to be a voluntary muscle, voluntary skeletal muscle. All right, so this looks like just a typical synapse, except when the muscle contracts, it moves around, so there are some additional structures like this invagination right here, this neuromuscular cleft that the axon terminus fits into so that the muscle doesn't pull away from the axon terminus. All right, so there's some different differences between those different synapses. Okay, a motor unit. Here I see two somatic motor neurons leaving the spinal cord. And you could probably tell me, what root is this that these things are leaving by? The ventral root, right? And you should remember these neurons to be nice multipolar neurons. And nice fast signals come down over here. And this somatic motor neuron, we could count the number of axon termini. I see like 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. This is what we call a motor unit, right? So if an impulse moves down this neuron, it's going to stimulate these 8 cells, and only these 8 cells in this particular skeletal muscle. And a skeletal muscle fiber will contract with 100% of its ability. It's not a graded contraction. Right, so if each muscle cell can only contract with a maximal contraction, why is it that you can pick up something very light or something really heavy with the same muscle. Why can you gradate how much force a muscle is producing when it's stimulating? If a muscle cell always does it maximally, why is it that you can produce a weak muscle contraction compared to a strong muscle contraction if each of these muscle cells contract maximally every time it's stimulated? That's because all of these muscle fibers within a muscle, okay, are not connected together with one motor neuron. There are many motor neurons going to them, and these motor neurons will stimulate maybe a different number of nerve fibers, and that's what we call a motor unit. So there are multiple motor units that go to a skeletal muscle, and if you need a weak contraction, maybe one motor unit is activated. If you need a little bit stronger contraction, maybe two. But if you're going to lift up a car battery, maybe you need all of these muscle fibers to contract, in which case all of the motor units will be stimulated to produce a maximal contraction in this particular skeletal muscle. So the way that we explain graded contractions or various tensions produced by a muscle is by recruitment. Recruitment is the term, right? So you need more tension produced by this muscle, you need to recruit more motor neurons. Does everybody kind of see that? Okay. The innervation ratio is the number of muscle fibers that are stimulated for every single neuron. Right, so in this particular case, I see three muscle fibers are going to contract due to one neuron. And we come up with a ratio, right? That would be 1 to 3. There are some as high as 1 to 2,000. So that's going to produce a much greater contraction than a 1 to 3 or even a 1 to 100. And probably you should realize in different parts of your body you have different innervation ratios, right? For instance, in your face and your hand, there are very few muscles that are connected to one muscle somatic motor neuron because you need to have fine control and dexterity and not a lot of tension being produced. But for instance, postural muscles in your back, right? You don't do a lot of dexterous things with your back. Those back muscles are either contracted or not to maintain equilibrium. So there are very few, or the innervation is very large. Okay. And we talked about recruitment to gradate strength. Structure of a muscle fiber. All right, what's the organelle of contraction called once again? The organelle inside the cell, right? Organelle is inside the cell. It is the myofibril. Okay, so here's a muscle fiber. The sarcolemma is the cell membrane. And I can see many nuclei inside the cell, which is kind of funny and atypical. And I see myofibrils. And even inside of myofibrils, I see myofilaments. Okay, and then I see this repeated pattern because what repeats itself over and over and over again? Sarcomeres, right? Those sarcomeres that line up produce that striated appearance. And these biofilaments, two main kinds. There are thick ones that we call myosin and thin ones that we call actin. Here is a really good example of a sarcomere. And okay, the thick filaments block a lot of light and it produces a dark band. That dark band is what we call the A band. Right? And that's really handy because there's an A in dark. That's really nice. And where there is no myosin, right, then things can be transmitted through this part of the sarcomere, whether it's an electron or light, and so it produces a light band. And that light band is what we call the I band. And again, that's kind of fortunate, right, because there's an I in light. And the sarcomere, the extent of the sarcomere is from Z-disc to Z-disc. Those are the ends of a sarcomere. And attached to a Z-disc is an actin protein. This is the thin filament on both sides. Right, so this is the extent of the sarcomere right here. And in the very center is the thick filament or myosin. And there is an M line due to some proteins that stabilize the myosin filaments right smack in the middle of the sarcomere. And I see that when there is overlap of actin and myosin, that produces the darkest band because both proteins are there. If there's just myosin, it produces a relatively dark band. Nonetheless, these two things join up to make the A band. Okay, so this is a sarcomere. So we got actin and myosin. When a myofibril contracts, these Z discs get pulled closer together. They move together. Right? And so when I think of that, then I think, well, maybe this myosin gets shorter, or maybe this actin gets shorter. Right? If these Z lines are going to come closer together, sure makes sense that one or both of these proteins has to get shorter. So what do you guys think? Which one gets shorter? Okay, and the answer is, I guess you guys know this, neither of them get shorter. What happens is that these filaments slide over each other. We call that the sliding filament mechanism. Right, so they start to slide over each other. So this Z-disc comes closer to this end of the myosin. This Z-disc over here comes closer to the end of the myosin on the other side. Right, and then the Z-discs are closer together. But if we were to look at the myosin molecule, it would be exactly the same when the sarcomere is short compared to when it's relaxed. And exactly the same thing for actin. It's going to be exactly the same length. Okay. This figure right here just shows that a sarcomere, or these filaments, are just not a flat piece of paper, but surrounding every myosin filament are actin filaments. And surrounding every actin filament all the way around are myosin filaments. So they surround each other, right? So here is a myosin, it's surrounded by actin. Here's an actin, it's surrounded by myosin filaments. Just because of that special nature of the interaction between actin and myosin. One thing maybe you didn't learn so much about in anatomy is a third kind of protein, and there's actually a couple more that we're going to look at. This thing is called chitin. And chitin is an elastic protein. And what can you tell me about elastic proteins? How do they behave? Yeah, if you stretch it, they go back to their resting length. But if they're at their resting length and let go, what's going to happen to them? They're just going to stay their normal length, right? So a chitin molecule does not aid in contraction. Only actin and myosin do, because right now it's at its resting length. There's no tension produced by it. But if we stretch the sarcomere, then this chitin molecule will have a tendency to bring it back to its normal resting length. So muscle does have elasticity because of these chitin molecules. Okay. All right, so here's a slide that just shows, if maybe with a ruler or something, measure the myosin molecule when the sarcomere is relaxed, measure it again when it's partially contracted, measure it again when the sarcomere is completely contracted, and you'll see that it is exactly the same length. And the same thing for the actin, right? Its length does not change. But something does change when these sarcomeres contract. Can you tell me what changes? And here are some micrographs that show the change that is illustrated down below over here. Okay, look at these light areas. What happens to that light area? The I band decreases or even goes away. The H zone, which is that area that we see myosin, but no overlap of actin. So it's a relatively light area. What happens to that H zone? The H zone completely goes away, right? And that's what we see over here. All right, so you should be able to say what bands disappear and have a pretty good idea of why that's happening. It's the interaction between these filaments. I'm going to show you some videos, but probably not today. All right, so here is actin and myosin, and review maybe some of these other components of the actin molecule when we come back next time. Things like tropomyosin and troponin. And another molecule that's necessary, the energy molecule that's necessary. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. It's around. It's okay.